And welcome to the Impact Interviews. My name's Laura, and today I'm delighted to welcome Aziz Sheikh, co-director of the ASME UK Centre for Applied Research. Hi, Aziz.
Hi, Laura. Great to be with you.
Hi, thanks ever so much for joining us today. So these are the Impact Interviews. So what I would like to start off by asking you is, what do you think impact is, and why should anyone care?
Well, I think impact fundamentally for me is about making a difference, and that difference can be at different levels in the system. So it can be making a difference to people's lives. I mean, I think that's what we're fundamentally interested in. It can be making an impact on sort of the way care is delivered and organized. So it's largely through professional organizations and working with professionals. But I think there's also the opportunity to make an impact at a policy level, so working with governments and related entities. Because ultimately, I mean, these other sort of dimensions also then have the opportunity to kind of translate into impact on people's lives. But fundamentally, for me, it's about making a difference.
And why should people care about making an impact? Why should they even bother?
Well, I think for us as researchers, the reason that we come into this is because we think research has the opportunity to kind of uncover truths in a generalizable way. And so really, I mean, ultimately, yes, we might get research grants, we may get papers, we may get some press coverage, etc. But over and above that, if this doesn't translate into improvements in some kind of way or new insights that are impactful, on the individual, on communities, on society, then for me the question is, well, why on earth are we doing this? So I think it's core to our raison d'être, really.
Core to the purpose of life, cool. And so obviously we're here to talk about the ASME UK Centre for Applied Research, which is a bit of a mouthful, but you as the co-director, you alongside Chris, you've got obviously the whole history of the 10 years of the centre and its emergence from the University of Edinburgh and how it's evolved over the time. So I was wondering if you could tell us, what is it, who cares about it, and why is it amazing?
Yeah, no, I think the ASME UK Centre for Applied Research, or AUKCAR as we kind of refer to it in short, is absolutely fantastic in that it's brought together brilliant academic groups from across the UK working hand in glove in concert with a fantastic group of patient and public involvement advocates. And we have probably the largest grouping of that kind anywhere in the world. And then also working with professionals and policymakers. So I think that combination is pretty unique, really. And there are loads of impacts that we've had as a group. Excuse me. Excuse me. There are loads of impacts that we've had as a group, but the one I probably wanted just to single out is the impact that we've had during the pandemic, really. And the reason why I wanted to do this was right at the outset, and this is a kind of a painful recollection for all of us, was that there were concerns that it was patients with asthma because of their underlying kind of respiratory conditions were at increased risk of developing severe COVID-19 outcomes. That's COVID hospitalization, or even worse still, dying from COVID. So understandably, there was a lot of concern in the large numbers of people living with asthma in the UK and indeed globally. I think one of the things that we were able to do as a centre was actually to do some of the work around developing what we call risk prediction algorithms. So these are sort of mathematical tools that can factor in a lot of variables to try and understand, well, actually, who was at risk of these severe outcomes. And we were able to do this at the request of the chief medical officers, I mean, across the UK, led by Sir Chris Whitty, chief medical advisor to the UK. And these algorithms showed, thankfully, that asthma was probably not one of the kind of major risk factors. There were other conditions that were sort of particularly predisposing to the risk of these severe COVID-19 outcomes. So I think that was reassuring for the community. I think then there was subsequent work that we were asked to do by the Joint Commission on Vaccination and Immunisation, JCVI, as kind of popularly known. And they asked us to try and help identify who within the sort of large numbers of asthma patients across the UK should be prioritised for vaccines. Because, I mean, as you'll recall, listeners will recall, initially vaccines were sort of being made available to those who would benefit most. And what we were able to do is run some very large studies, I mean, across Scotland and England, really the first of their kind in the world. And what we were able to show what that was, if your asthma was well controlled, then you weren't at any increased risk and you probably shouldn't be prioritised. But those who had been recently hospitalised, those who had poor controls, as judged by sort of recent exacerbations, were at increased risk. And so those individuals were prioritised. That fed through into policy making, and then vaccine rollout and delivery. So I think these are kind of examples of impacts that we were having across the country in as close to as real time as possible. And that was not only for the UK, but because these were the first analyses of their kind being run anywhere in the world, these were having then global ramifications. I think the last thing I want to say on that front, Laura, if I may, is that one of the sort of silver linings of the pandemic, and there weren't very many, one of them sort of I sort of recalled is that when we were allowed to go out for walks, because prior to that we'd been sort of not allowed, we were allowed out for an hour a day.
Yeah.
And there was no traffic. And what I remember, the bird song that we kind of was hearing was absolutely phenomenal. I'd never heard anything like that in the UK before. But another silver lining was that we were able to demonstrate that during that lockdown period, the number of people being admitted to hospital with asthma exacerbations fell really dramatically.
All right.
And there were sort of, we did that work in Wales, and we did it sort of independently in Scotland, and then we did it in England as well. So we replicated that work and really seeing the same signal across all three countries of the UK. The Northern Ireland data weren't available at the time, but we've subsequently been able to do that as well, retrospectively, and seeing a very similar signal. And there were concerns, well, is this because people weren't presenting because the kind of system, the NHS, was not really functioning that well, or maybe they were dying at home because of their asthma? But actually, we looked at all of those kind of scenarios, and these were actually real declines in asthma exacerbations. Very substantive, the greatest declines that we've ever seen in the UK's history.
Wow, okay.
And the reason for that, and we've just been running some, and it was really because of the kind of social distancing measures, the kind of the non-pharmaceutical interventions, NPIs as they're called, so the masks that we were wearing, there was far less transmission of respiratory tract infections. And that was probably the driver of all of this. I think the other thing that we saw was that because there were concerns in the asthma community, people became more compliant with vaccinations in the round. They were taking their preventer inhalers more sort of religiously or as prescribed. And so those preventive measures in the round were being taken up. And so I think there are just, I mean, it was an example of something that we never set out to do. It wasn't on the agenda, but circumstances demanded that we had the kind of greatest respiratory asthma expertise in the country. The circumstances demanded that we use this to the benefit of the wider society. And I'm really proud of what we did as a community, really, on that front. Made some really important advances that impacted. So not only generated papers, and actually the impact came first, the papers came second, because we were feeding this directly into government decision-making processes. And I'm really pleased that government really accepted what we were doing. They trusted what we were doing. So people like Chris Whitty, Patrick Balance, Gregor Smith, I mean, the CMOs, the chief scientific advisors, they were just incredibly receptive to what we were doing. And so that was really heartening, actually.
And it's also good to hear that there was something good that could come out of something so terrible, you know. And so I'm also interested in what you said a little bit earlier about it wasn't just in the UK, because you guys were the first ones to do this kind of work, and therefore it didn't only inform the UK's response, but it also informed responses elsewhere. Are you able to comment a little bit about that and how far it spread?
Yeah, so for example, I mean, we had direct liaisons with French authorities, Canadian, with Mexican. So, I mean, a number of countries in disparate parts of the world. And the reason is sort of fundamentally, we've got brilliant science in the UK. That's one, so that's trusted across the world. We've got an NHS, and the data emerging from the back end of the NHS was really enabled as a result of sort of decisions taken from on high. So there were real-time access to data on the entire population, and there's virtually nowhere else in the world that that was available. And to top that, we had brilliant scientists working on those data. So those ingredients you can't find really virtually only anywhere else in the world, really.
And actually, probably they take a bit.
Yeah, my sort of, it's a frustration, I guess, really. I can't describe it in any other way, is that we created this really enabling environment during the pandemic where sort of the brakes were sort of put off and we were supported. And actually, most of the scientific advances in relation to the pandemic came from the UK as a consequence of all of that. I mean, it's completely disproportionate if you look. And what that then means is that if we could bring that similar kind of infrastructure, expertise, kind of muscle together, pulling in the same direction, then I'm sure we could sort out so many other things, including major advances for asthma. And but I think that the challenge is that sort of in peacetime, we revert back to normal and these things become so much more difficult, unfortunately. But maybe that's a story for another day, Laura.
Well, also what's crossing my mind is that this expertise just doesn't pop up overnight, right? And that is the point of the centre, isn't it? To sort of train people up, make sure they've got the best practice, the best sets of experience, the best network, the best connections, the best ways of working together, so that when these things are called upon, which was the need in the time of COVID, that is already there to be called upon. And then once the network is working brilliantly, then maybe we can apply the expertise to the next set of challenges as you outlined. But it can't just happen like without the training, without the network, without the expertise being shared. And that's part of the purpose of the centre, isn't it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, so Rome wasn't built in a day, obviously. And and so these things take time, they take investment, and not just doing sort of financial investment, but it's investment in the relationships and the fact that we've got such high degrees of trust amongst sort of groups working in different UK nations, different institutions. They I mean, they wear those hats, obviously, but I think when it comes to this, we've got sort of phenomenal trust. And what we've done is actually with our PhD students, we baked this in right from the outset. Because, for example, we insisted that they were being trained by supervisors working sort of across more than one university. That was, I don't think that's ever happened before, but it was sort of, for us, it was something that we sort of absolutely insisted on. And so these guys are trained in these kind of collaborative leadership models of working right from the outset. And that, I think that's for the good, because ultimately we're not in this for individual accolades or university rankings or anything like that. We're in this to try and sort of make people's lives better.
Yeah. And so if you think about the people listening to this podcast, a lot of them will be at the beginning of their journey and will be thinking, okay, right, I'm a clinician, scientist, researcher. And obviously I want to maintain my scientific integrity, but obviously I've got this impact thing to think about. How should these people start to consider impact in terms of how they go about their daily life? And do you have any advice or tips for them as they start?
Yeah, so I think, the kind of foundation of all of this is sort of outstanding science, really. And so that scientific integrity just can't be compromised under any circumstances. That's number one. I mean, I think what can help in that respect is then maybe doing less and actually sort of focusing on ensuring the quality. But I think also What can really help is if you are engaged with those who are ultimately going to be impacted right from the outset, so members of the public. And again, for our PhD students, for example, we've insisted on that they can't get their PhDs up unless they've actually seriously engaged with members of the public who are affected, or sort of professionals or decision makers or whatever. I mean, so actually trying to work out the questions that are sort of pressing, if they generate high quality evidence to answer those questions, there's a chance that that's going to impact. So, I mean, I think that's kind of one set of considerations. I think the other thing is that not everything is impactful. I mean, some of it is stepping stone. I mean, some of it's foundational, et cetera. And so it's, I mean, don't expect everything to impact. And lastly, impact for me, I mean, I've learned this probably the hard way. It's not kind of a linear process. I mean, the kind of model many of us as academics have in our head is that you do brilliant science, you publish a paper, you get a bit of press coverage, and then somebody takes it up. It doesn't work like that.
No.
The reality is that, I mean, the engagement should begin right from the outset, including trying to answer, I mean, prioritize questions that you want to try and answer. And then it's a kind of a drip feed. It's ongoing relationships, it's trust, etc. It's getting sort of permission, a seat around the table where decisions are made. And that can sometimes happen directly. It can sometimes happen indirectly through your colleagues, etc. But what you want is to be able to present what you're doing to people who are making decisions, but doing that in a timely way. So if decisions have already been made and you present, well, I mean, the boat has sailed. But if, I mean, for example, sort of there is an election cycle, or parties are formulating their kind of manifestos, that's obviously the time to get in. But once those manifestos have been formulated, well, they're pretty much locked for the next 5 years. So, yeah, I mean, engagement, high quality science can't be compromised. But then also timeliness and getting a seat around the table would be my tips.
Yeah. And so maybe serendipity's got a bit to play, and also communication, great communication.
No, absolutely. I mean, sometimes, I mean, there are things that you anticipate are going to generate enormous kind of traction, and they don't. And other things you think, well, how on earth did that happen?
And you take those with the grace that's given. Aziz, that's fantastic. Thank you ever so much for joining me today. I've really enjoyed speaking to you, and looking forward to seeing you at the conference next week.
Yeah, great speaking with you, Laura. Thanks so much. Thank
Brilliant.
You.
Brilliant. Thanks.
Bye.
Hello and welcome to the Impact Interviews. My name's Laura and I'm going to be your host today. And today I am delighted to welcome Dr. Hilary Pinnock. Hilary is a GP by background and she has led the self-management program for Ask Me UK Centre for Applied Research since its inception over 10 years ago. Hi, Hilary.
Hello.
Hi, welcome. So, Hilary, these are the Impact Interviews. So I've got to start by asking you, what do you think impact is? Why do you think anyone should care?
I guess I would define impact as making a difference.
Mm-hmm.
Making a difference, obviously, to people living with asthma in the context of the Asthma UK Centre, but also making a difference to the professionals who are looking after those people, making a difference to early career researchers and PhD students who are working alongside us. So it is around making a difference, something that I was going to say measurable. I'm not sure measurable, which implies numbers, is quite necessarily the right word. But somewhere people, it's the pleasure of having somebody say that made a difference. Or I've thought about things differently since we looked at this or we discussed that. So it's making a difference. It's difficult to measure it in figures, and that sometimes is challenging. But making.
So why do you think people should care?
How do you mean by should people care? Because, I mean, we all care about our health. Patients care about living with their condition. Professionals care because they want to do things better. You know, as a GP, I wanted to do the best I could. So I do care that I'm doing things well. Early career researchers, PhD students care because they want to achieve a career. So if we can do something to help them do it better, that's impact.
Wow. Okay. So you have led the self-management program. So for our lightning round, could you tell us what is the self-management program? Who cares? And why is it amazing?
Okay. The word self-management sounds like it's a thing, doesn't it? It sounds more sort of official.
Yeah.
First of all, we only ever talk about supported self-management because self-management isn't something I give to a patient. Self-management is something I support a patient to look after themselves better. I cannot give self-management. People are looking after themselves by definition. Every minute of every day, they are taking decisions about the medicine they're going to use, the activities they're going to do, whether or not they need medical care. They are taking those decisions. So I am not giving anybody self-management. I am supporting them to live better. So I often use the terminology supporting people to live with their asthma.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly never use the term self-management without supported, because that's my role, is to support them.
Okay. And so who cares about supported self-management?
People living with asthma, because they are living with a long-term condition. And although many of them will have worked out ways of making it work, the more I can help, I have clinical knowledge, academic knowledge, and if I can help people with that, then that can affect and improve their lives. They know how it's like to live with it. I have the clinical knowledge, and it's merging those two that, if you like, is amazing.
And so why is this amazing and not good or great? Why is it amazing?
Because I think it's actually the fundamental role that we have as clinicians.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yes, there are technical things that we can do. You know, if you're a surgeon, you can operate. There are things that you could do that are technical. I can give a drug, a pharmacological treatment. But when it comes to it, I think one of the key things that I have done throughout a career in medicine is to support people to live with their conditions, to help them to understand their conditions, know when to worry and when not to worry,
mm-hmm.
What drugs are likely to help them, how to recognise when things are not going so well. So I think it's actually the core of what we do in medicine.
Mm-hmm. And so if we think about some of the people that you've helped or communities that you've helped or anything, without giving anyone's kind of confidential information away, I'm not asking you to do that. But could you think of any examples or stories that you can tell us where that supported self-management has transformed someone's life? And how did that happen?
I think it transformed. I mean, difficult to know where to start with that.
Yeah.
Because quite clearly, I could talk about, you know, from a professional perspective, I can talk about the patients who sometimes after many years of discussion and getting to know them and understand their problems, will suddenly begin to understand how they can live better with their asthma.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really rewarding when a patient says, oh, you mean if I took those inhaled steroids, those preventer treatments regularly, I might not have an attack like this. And I'm thinking, yeah, this is what I've been hoping you'd understand for a while. So I'm actually now supporting them. So that is really rewarding. The patients who, from a professional perspective, the patients who tell me that this is rewarding. From an academic perspective, it is really rewarding working with a team of people. The project that I've been working on is called IMPART.
Mm-hmm. And what's that?
That is implementing improved asthma self-management as a routine. So, but the important thing is that it's there to try and embed supported self-management as a way of working in GP practices.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really rewarding working with a team, some of whom knew more about supported self-management than others. So we've had people join our team who have learnt about supported self-management, and I've learnt from them the skills that they bring. So this working in a team has been really, really important. And we've had a team working on this now for the best part of a decade. So that's been very rewarding. It's been rewarding also in order to be able to get involved with capacity building.
Mm-hmm.
Supporting, we've had three PhD students aligned with the IMPART programme of work,
mm-hmm.
One of whom has graduated and two of whom are still working through their PhD. And that's rewarding because they learn about how you can, about running a large programme of work. But they also teach us a lot because of what they bring, a fresh view to things. So that's been rewarding. And that, of course, aligns very much with the other role that I have within the ASME UK Centre, which is as one of the postgraduate co-leads.
With Gwen.
I've been with Gwen. Mm. And that's been another rewarding feature to watch the students coming through, many of whom have stayed with us or been working in aligned areas and we're still in contact with. So that's been really very rewarding as well. The other thing we've done in the IMPART work, and we're going to be talking a little bit about this at the ASM next week, is we've tried to bring in master students and undergraduates who have projects to do, and we've tried mm-hmm. to align projects. We've got something like 20 students who've been aligned with the IMPART work. Now, there again, what you're doing there is sowing seeds of several things. You're sowing seeds of what supported self-management is, what is so important about helping people live with their condition. But you're also sowing the seeds of academic work, of health service research, of implementation research. So that's really rewarding, particularly when they come back a couple of years later and they have another project to do. Can we help with another project? Or they want to write a paper and they ask you to help with them. So there's a great deal of rewards to be had at every different level.
And so that's been over the last 10 years.
Yes.
And we're now thinking about the next 10 years. And so if all of that good stuff happened in the last 10 years, what do you think you could be most excited about in terms of the future?
I think we're going to be broadening our agenda. This has been a very focused program of work around asthma.
Mm-hmm.
And I think being able to spread some of that to a broader areas of respiratory care, respiratory research, I think that will be very rewarding. I feel that we have learnt a lot, particularly about the benefits of PhD programmes, particularly mm-hmm. about the benefits of programme grants where you have space to build a team. And I think, and to really get into a topic area in depth, I think that's been those are things that I have certainly learnt, appreciated, and been very rewarding. And I hope we can continue, but looking perhaps at a broader areas of respiratory medicine.
And so, as we enter this next phase and new people come in, do you have any wise words or top tips for anyone coming into the area who's thinking about creating impact?
I think if there is a word I would want to use, it's enthusiasm.
Right, okay, yeah.
Because if you want to work with whoever you're working with, whether it's with patients that you're caring for, whether it's with early career researchers that you're trying to support, whether it's with colleagues, whether you're trying to make a difference at policy level, if you're enthusiastic yourself and you actually believe in what you're doing, then I think the chances of it making a difference increase.
And how do you keep up your enthusiasm in the dark days of bad results and hard work?
I don't know that it's that difficult, really. yes, it's hard work. Yes, there's a lot to do, but I don't actually find it difficult to keep up enthusiasm for something that I believe in, for something that I know, something that is rewarding. And something which I think is so fundamental to our clinical practice and to how healthcare services should be supporting people. So I don't actually find it that difficult to keep up enthusiasm.
More a calling than a profession.
Well, I suppose medicine's always been described like that.
Yeah. Oh, and so do you have any final wise words for people listening to the podcast anywhere around the world?
Work with other people. Collaborate. Yeah. Work with other people. Recognize that as an individual you don't know everything. Recognize that whether you're talking to patients or colleagues, whoever you're talking to, there are people with different perspectives that can contribute. We could not have achieved as much as we had with the IMPART program if I hadn't had around me people who had skills that I had not got. Mm-hmm. And that is absolutely crucially important. So yes, collaborate, talk to other people, keep going, because yes, it is hard work sometimes, and try and share that enthusiasm and interest.
Oh, that's really lovely. Hilary, thank you so much. Thank you. I've really enjoyed talking to you, and see you next week.
See you next week.
Thanks for listening to the Impact Interviews. If you enjoyed this episode, then please check out our back catalogue. And if you've any questions for either us or our guests, then please be sure to get in touch. We'll be back next week with something new. So see you soon.